Hello and welcome to Super Saturdays, a comic book media podcast, where each episode we'll be focusing on your favorite comic books, TV shows, and movies to figure out if these projects will stand the test of time. And on today's episode, we got a special interview with a local artist. But before I reveal who it is, before he reveals who he is, I'm Damon A. And like I said, on today's episode, we're joined by a special guest, and that guest is...
Hi, my name is Sean Peacock. I'm an illustrator and comic artist based out of Metro Detroit. I am the author, illustrator, creator of Peppermint Desert, a comic that I self-publish under my brand All Sorrows, and with hopefully some cool stuff to come in the future.
All right. Well, on with the show. Well, it is great to have you on the show, Sean. I met you twice at Motor City Comic Con, and it was great meeting you and also seeing your art, and I'm a huge fan of your art. Funny enough, before even meeting you and getting to know the rest of your work, I actually have a print of yours on my wall downstairs in my living room.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, and it was from a friend of mine. We have a lot of memories around over the garden wall, and for Christmas, he got your print, I think, at a festival a year or two ago, and he gave it to me. And I had no idea that you're the artist who drew it. He just told me, the local artist does a lot of horror stuff and also comic stuff and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he was like, I can't remember his name, but I love his stuff. And then it just so happened, last year at Comic-Con in November, I walked past your stuff and I was like, wait a second. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
So small world.
Yeah, for real. No, that's so funny. It is truly a trip when people stop by my booth at a Comic-Con or something and be like, whoa, I don't know you, but I know your art because my friend got X print for me the other a couple of years ago. And I'm like, my reputation precedes me. That's strange.
I feel like that's a really good moment, though. I feel like it's kind of up there with having a moment of being like, wow, I made it.
Yeah. It is. It's very odd. And it's one thing to happen. It's one thing for it to happen, in my hometown or close to my hometown. I went to the Toronto Comic Arts Festival a couple months back, and there were people that showed up to my table there who were from Toronto who were we saw on social media that you were going to be here. And the only reason we came out here was to see your stuff. And I was like, this is a different country, bro. It's insane.
Well, it's damn good. Seriously, I love your stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Of course.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate that.
No problem. There's going to be more moments of me giving you compliments on your art, so don't worry.
Ah.
But before we get ahead of ourselves, before we get into the meat and potatoes of our special episode of Hot Ones, would you like to do some news roundup?
Oh, for sure.
All right.
Lay it on me.
All right. What was your thoughts on, Michael Keaton movie? Did you like the Michael Keaton movie, the Batman movie?
From the 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that one. It's I get people, have gripes with it because it's, not comic accurate, which, it's not. It's so much fun and it's so weird. And it's, the era of Tim Burton where he's at his best. And I feel like you don't get, such a weird singular depiction of a superhero on screen anymore. The Batman kind of came close.
Yeah.
But it's so weird and has such insane ambiance and art direction and performances. I'm a big fan of Michael Keaton Batman.
I love Keaton Batman, the Tim Burton movies. I do. And, I think last year during Christmas time, I rewatched Batman Returns for the first time in a long-ass time. And I was watching that movie, and that movie is kind of... And I mean this in the nicest way. It is a dumpster fire, but it's a pretty dumpster fire. It is a pretty dumpster fire that I would totally pick up a lawn chair and sit in front of and watch it every single year.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over the place, but I love it for that. And I also love the performances and I love the little bits and pieces. And I just love how gothic and how weird and just how like I love it. I love it. So a couple, yeah. couple years ago when the first Batman 89 book came out, and even when the Superman 78 book came out, I was kind of excited because it was like we're getting a chance to really like look back on that. So this piece of news, Joe Quiñones, I think it's Joe Quiñones, revealed his first look and the sequel to the first Batman 89 series books.
Ooh.
Called Batman 89 Echoes, revealed his look at Catwoman, and she has a bob and some BDSM gear, and well, like semi BDSM, but
sure,
I love the bob. I wish I could like have it up here if you didn't see it, but pretty cool. Or if you want to take a second to look it up, you can go ahead and look it up.
Yeah, I have to see this because I never read any of the Batman 89 comics. But I understand that they're supposed to be pretty good, and they're like an adaptation of a screenplay that was written like in the early 90s or something, right? And it
well, kind of like I know that like when because I read like the first couple issues, and they took bits and pieces of stuff that was gonna be in it originally, and then made its own thing. I know that they kept that Robin was introduced in 89. And he was black, which is supposed to be like similar to like how originally, you know, with Marlon Wayans, he's supposed to play Robin until they cut him out, which he still gets a check from that movie to this day.
Huh.
Residuals, I think. Funny enough.
Interesting. I do appreciate how like weird and horny those like 80s Batman movies are, just because I feel like Batman and his like whole suite of characters are kind of inherently weird and horny, and that kind of have been since their inception. And I think it's fun when they're kind of done justice like that. Not that they have to be like that all the time, but I think that's fun. And like just looking at these images, I see like it's like a cool redesign of Harley. I see like a Batgirl. Like that's awesome. That's cool. Like I love seeing like all these characters reimagined through the lens of like 80s Tim Burton Batman. That's fun.
I'm curious. I think I want to get back and look into it. So we got another piece of DC news. And you know, DC Compact Comics. This is a new initiative that they're putting out.
Yeah.
They're going to be putting out like full graphic novel stories in compact form, but also making it affordable. I think they're like $5 or $9.
They're $10.
$10. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited about these. I already put a bunch on order from my local comic books shop. Like a bunch of the ones that are like available for order. I already put out like the Far Sector one is waiting for me to pick up, and like probably tomorrow. And I've been saying for years that like manga has this surge in popularity that's like most young people who are reading any form of like comics or sequential art are most likely reading manga. They're reading like Chainsaw Man or Demon Slayer or something like that. And I think this is like the way for the big two to kind of like break into that demographic and like make themselves a little bit more accessible, because $4 a month for 32 pages for a single book is like something that I'm willing to pay as a fucking nerd, but like most teenagers or like people younger than that, or even just people who don't want to shill that much money every month, like this is way more accessible and it's a better deal. It's so many pages for $10. That's awesome. And it's books that like I've held out on reading for a really long time, like Far Sector or like Gotham City Sirens or American Vampire.
Gotham City Sirens is in the lineup. Like,
that's in the lineup.
Really?
I don't know. Yeah. It comes out like further into the fall, but they announced like a bunch of them, and Gotham City Sirens is one. Okay. I'm very excited about that because I've wanted to read it for years and I never got around to it. But this will be my excuse.
I only read like the first storyline, and it was great. It was great.
Yeah, it's Paul Dini, right? So yeah.
I mean,
it's gonna be awesome.
Who doesn't like Paul Dini? So
nobody. Yeah. No, I'm excited. I just hope that Marvel kind of does their own version of this. And I know that they've been doing like the like Marvel Masterworks that are like smaller, that are like maybe $15 or something. But like, I think they can take that even further. I just want Marvel to do their own version of this.
I feel like they are, because they always like both parties copy off each other. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. I feel like I wonder who's going to be the first to change the way comics are going to be made. Because some people are theorizing, or at least suggesting, maybe comics should go the way the manga does, and the way they release their, like, you know, full collection of stories, maybe like concurrently, or maybe like every single month or whatever. Because the whole small ass issue for $4 once a month, mm-hmm. not always lucrative.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not like I worked in a comic book shop for a couple of years, and yeah, like there are definitely the people who are like dedicated and are like about that life, but like I'll give an example. I just came off of reading like the Krakoa era X-Men stuff, like that whole like era of X-Men comics just ended, and now they're like doing their whole soft reboot into like the next era of X-Men.
And where were you in March? You should have been on Mute in March.
Oh shit, man, I would have loved to. I love X-Men. But like, I just came off of reading all that stuff, and for a good 5 years, like since 2019, I had been paying for like 5 to 6 X-Men books per month. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of paper. It's a lot of money to spend. Not that I didn't enjoy it. I very much did, but it's like a tall order, to the point where like, now that like this new era of X-Men stuff is starting, like I'm gonna keep with it for a little bit. Or at least with like one or two of the books, but like my time of like paying for every single book is over, because it's just so much. And I really appreciate any lengths that Marvel or DC or anybody else goes to just fuck around with like the way that comics are distributed and stuff. Like a little while back when DC was doing all their Future State stuff, they had kind of adopted this model of like, okay, we're gonna sell you a 48 page book, and like 32 of those pages is gonna be like Batwoman, and then you'll get like a couple of backups that might be like Catwoman or Nightwing or whatever. And I think that was interesting. I think taking a manga approach like the like compact editions is a good idea. I could even see like an anthology, like Shonen Jump yeah. approach, where like instead of having to buy like 4 books a month, you pay like $10 and you just get like a thick ass magazine that would have like that month's issue of like Spider-Man, Iron Man, X-Men, whatever, and then you just like get one thick ass book a month or something like that. I don't know. I'm just like, I'm all for whatever they want to experiment with, as long as I'm paying less for more pages, I'm about it.
Honestly, I feel like the Shonen Jump approach would be a good way to put characters, the characters that people love, but for some reason their books aren't selling well. And instead of having 50-11 different series and titles and relaunching and everything, that could be their way of giving that character some life outside of having the yeah. full-on series. And if it does well enough, then go ahead and be like, hey, we're going to give you a series again. You know what I mean? I think that would Absolutely. Be a good way to do it, too.
And it would help kind of sell the idea of the interconnected world.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people, like, especially people who like come out of the MCU and go into Marvel, like expect this idea of like, okay, all these books take place in the same world, they're all interconnected, and to a very great extent they are. But if you come in on the right, on like the wrong issue, it's like just Iron Man running around. I don't know. But like the idea that you could have like multiple of these books kind of combined per month is just like, okay, like here's what every Marvel character is doing for the month of July 2024. And then you'll follow each of these characters. So it would almost give like the whole Marvel or DC universe this sense of like chronology, mm-hmm. where it's like, here's what all these characters are doing right now. And then next month, you'll see what they're doing next, you know?
All right. Are you ready to get in the meat and potatoes of this interview?
Yeah, let's do it, man.
Okay. So, Sean, you are obviously a huge comic fan.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first introduction to the comic book world?
Man, it's like I can't even remember because I was so young. My dad is a longtime collector of comics, longtime comic book fan of things both like Cape and more like alternative. So my entire childhood was just growing up on like Silver Age Marvel and DC back issues, just random issues from like the 60s through the 80s, whatever I could get my hands on in like secondhand shops or whatever. And yeah, that's just kind of grown and blossomed. And as soon as I was like old enough to walk around the comic book store on my own, I was just picking up random stuff, kind of giving myself a comics education, letting my dad give me a comics education, hanging out with comic book artists more recently. Yeah, it's hard to say when it started. It just kind of feels like it's always been there.
Okay. So with that being said, what was your favorite character or characters, plural?
It's I feel like it changes pretty frequently, although I've always had a very great affinity for like the Bat family and the Batman Rogues gallery. You know, like I love Batman. We all love Batman. I'm a big fan of like the like Nightwing Batgirl Robin dynamic. I love the Riddler. He's so ridiculous. And I've just like always I've been the Riddler multiple times for Halloween. There's just something about him that I think is like so interesting, and I love that like different interpretations of him can be like really really goofy or really really fucked up. And I guess that this the same can be said for any Batman villain. I spent significant hours in my childhood playing the Lego Batman video game on PS2,
That
and
was
that is just
me. Me
like
too. I fucking love that game.
the ultimate smorgasbord of like every Batman villain. It gives you a crash course into like every single character. And so yeah, that's where my love for that universe started.
You know, this is kind of off topic, no, very off topic, so this is going to be tangent territory. My partner got me a PS Vita for my birthday because it was last week. And so I like downloaded it because like there's like an emulator function on there that you can get, and I got like PSP games on there as well. So
Nice.
I downloaded Lego Indiana Jones and then Lego Batman, and like never had a PSP growing up, so childhood healed. But playing that, I was like, this is exactly the same game as the PS2 one, slightly different with graphics, but like it's exactly the
Whoa.
same game.
That's good to hear because I know that the DS one is like super different. So it
Yeah.
makes me happy that the PSP one is the same. That's great.
Yeah.
No, all of those Lego games. I feel like every Lego game up through like Pirates of the Caribbean or like Lego Batman 2, I was like all over. There was a certain cutoff where I stopped, but like
That a
those
Pirates of the
first, like,
Caribbean?
they had a Pirates of the Caribbean. It came out around the time that the fourth movie came out.
Really? That's one of those games I
Yeah.
forgot about. Like I know they had like the Lego City or whatever, and then they also had like Lego Batman 2, Lego Indiana Jones, Star Wars,
There's
a lot of
yeah,
other stuff.
they did Batman 3. They did a Lego Incredibles game. Can you believe that? They like that was more recently, but like truly they have brought there was dude, I had Lego Rock Band. I logged so
I
many
love that
hours of Lego
game. That
Rock
game was
Band.
fun,
Yeah.
yeah.
Insane set list. I had a big Guitar Hero Rock Band phase.
You know, like you said, you are an artist, and I have a couple of different projects that I got on here because I'm going to be pulling up some random ass questions. There might be a deep cut in there. There might be,
Hey,
potentially,
go for it.
one deep cut. I want to start by asking about your projects, and I want to ask about Comics Are Dying. You did the cover for that, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And I did one interior page for it as well.
Okay, can you talk about that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
That was a project that Lewis Southard came to me with. Lewis and I have been working together for a little while. The summer after I graduated college, he had put out like a job posting on Twitter because he needed a colorist for the second volume of Midnight Western Theater. And I hit him back because I just graduated college and I needed something to do. And I became the colorist on that series. That was very, very cool. A very fun, like straight out of college, like real comics gig that I got to do. and that book came out and it was great. And then Lewis and I have kind of like jammed on a few other things since then. We did some concept designs for a reimagined version of the Green Hornet, which never ended up seeing the light of day. But that was kind of cool. And I feel like there may have been something else that I'm forgetting about. But he came to me with this Comics Are Dying project, which was such a cool idea. And he asked me to illustrate the cover. And I jumped at it because it was he had a pretty decent idea of what he wanted. And I just took that and ran with it. And it was just a blast to put together. And then he, you know, was collecting artists to do the interior pages. For those who aren't in the know, each page of that comic is like a one page story about like some chapter of comics history. And each page is drawn by a different artist. And he asked me, like, if you could draw a page about anything in comics, like, what would it be? Like, what are your favorite things? And like the very first thing that I said was, I love Jack Kirby. I love, you know, just like Silver Age, like retro superhero comics. And so he gave me a script for a page that was kind of a takeoff on New Gods. And I just had a blast with that. I just kind of did like the Sean Peacock version of a Jack Kirby New Gods page. Went crazy with the patterns and the squiggly lines and half tones and everything, and it was a blast.
Was there some Kirby crackle?
Oh, tons. So much.
So like when you were chosen to do the Jack Kirby page and everything, what did you want to set out and bring to that?
I really wanted to do justice to the Jack Kirby style. I feel like there's, you know, my own style, just the way that I draw normally, takes a lot of inspiration from like mid-century comic book artists and the artists who were inspired by that, right? You know, like there's Kirby, there's Ditko, there's Alex Toth, and I love those guys. And other guys that I love are like Darwin Cook and Chris Samnee and Marcos Martin, and like all of these guys that like have these styles that kind of resemble that mid-century, very like geometric, sharp-edged comics approach. And so part of it was just me doing my thing, and part of it was me like really studying the work of Jack Kirby and trying to incorporate design elements and, you know, things from his artwork into my own. I went out and bought a hard copy of New Gods and had that sitting by my side as reference. And for only having to do a single page, it was great that it was just a single page because I just got to have fun with it. You know, when you have 48 pages ahead of you, it can be a little bit of weight on your shoulders, but it was just one page. Do a Jack Kirby tribute, dude. I got this. it was fun.
How long did it really take you to really perfect your style of art? And in what words would you describe your art?
I would describe my art as paying homage to that mid-century Silver Age style, really trying to incorporate real texture and grit. You know, I do all of my inking traditionally. I often make use of like misregistered colors or splatters. Like I really like the feeling that like ink has been put on a page, you know? And it took me a while, to kind of perfect that. Although I'm not sure that that's like the way I would put it. You know, I drew all the way through high school. You know, I've been drawing my whole life, right? But like, I really started like getting interested in going into comics when I was in high school. And I think to a certain extent, my art kind of still resembles what it looked like back then, but much better, obviously. You know, I went to art school. You know, the first couple of years are very basic. You know, you learn perspective drawing, you learn figure drawing, you learn how to paint. And I did a lot of exploration, really trying to like hunt for my style. And I remember being very, very frustrated at like you know, not really being able to capture like a certain sort of house style that I wanted to. You know, a lot of my teachers and classmates were doing like these paintings that were very rendered and had these mixed media approaches. And I did a little bit of that and I was okay, but my heart wasn't totally in it. And it wasn't until I kind of just like turned my brain off and stopped searching for the style and just started having fun that I found it. Because like during the summers between years of college, I started doing these mini comics, just like 9 to 16 page things, where I was just having fun and telling stories that I thought were interesting, and just doing that over and over and throwing myself into work that I was excited about, the style just kind of appeared naturally. And to this day, I don't really think that much about stylization. I kind of just draw the way I want to draw and it comes out. And that's kind of the advice I would give to anybody who's like really stressed about finding their style. It's kind of like falling in love, you know, the second you stop looking for it is when you're most likely going to find it.
You know, let's talk about Peppermint Desert a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. So a few things. Number one, I remember when I met you, you were telling me about it and everything. And it is about Mickey and Saturday as they're trying to escape mm-hmm. the devil across the desert. And from what I could see from it and everything, it like your style all throughout that. And where did you come up with the inspiration for that? I know that horror is one of your favorite things. So when you set out to do a lot of your work, did you always know you wanted to do stuff that had like a little bit of horror, or was it just like, you know, had an idea, put it to paper?
It's kind of, I have an idea and I put it to paper. I feel like, you know, I always have genre influences. I always have certain influences going into certain things. With Peppermint Desert specifically, their inspiration came from two places, or there's kind of like two columns, right? There's like the stylistic column, and then there's like what the book is actually about. And in the stylistic column, I had recently read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I love the movie Wild at Heart, which is a David Lynch movie with Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, which if you haven't seen it, is crazy, and I recommend it. Okay. I'm also just a big David Lynch fan, and he makes use of a lot of these like kind of anachronistic like 50s period tropes. And I knew that I kind of wanted to go for that kind of like rockabilly desert fast car aesthetic. So I also like spent that summer like watching a few different things. I watched Faster Pussycat Kill Kill and things of that nature. And so that all kind of culminated in the visual style of the book, which also was very inspired by music. Music is a huge part of my creative process. And if you look in the back of Peppermint Desert, there's a soundtrack with all the songs I was listening to while I made it, which I think kind of helps set the mood for the entire book. And it's a lot of rockabilly stuff, Wanda Jackson, The Phantom, a little bit of Elvis, but then also like the B-52s and the Cramps. And there's a little bit of psychedelia in there. There's like the 13th floor elevators and like Roxy Music and stuff. And that's where my mind was at when I was drawing it. And I think that really helped kind of put a spin on the story. And then the column of like what the book is actually about is it was like kind of me processing these feelings of imposter syndrome that I was getting sort of toward the back half of college. Peppermint Desert was kind of taking this idea of these two characters who are inherently lucky, and they are faced with a situation where that luck is stripped from them, and they have to confront this idea of like, are they anything without luck, or can they harness that luck and make it productive? And I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, if I'm in this situation, if I'm lucky, that's fine, as long as I don't use it for evil. And you know, it's more complex than that, but that was kind of where I was coming from the writing perspective. And so you take that kind of personal small thing and you blow it up 500 times and make the stakes fucking crazy, And then set it against these wild visuals and this soundtrack. And that's kind of how the concept for the book came about.
So is it safe to say that of all the things that you worked on, Peppermint Desert is your most favorite project that you've worked on so far in your career?
It is. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely the thing that is out, that is finished, that I can point to and say that I am very, very proud of that. And it's something that I can say that other people really, really like. Certainly of the things that have been released to the public, it is my favorite thing. I have a number of other irons in the fire for projects that I'm really, really excited about, including one I can't talk about yet, but I'm almost finished with it, and it's going to be really, really cool, and I'm very proud of it. But yeah, Peppermint Desert is, it's always a point of pride when I am at a convention or an art fair or something, and somebody kind of picks it up and goes like, what is this? And I'm like, hey, let me tell you about this very cool thing that I did. It is, if not the, then certainly one of my favorite things I have ever created.
Okay. Was it the most challenging?
Yeah, I'd say so. In a way, I think probably the most challenging has been, again, I'm sorry about this, but the thing that I just finished that I can't talk about yet. But at the time, it was certainly the most challenging. Peppermint Desert was my thesis project in college for my senior year. So I spent my whole senior year of school working on it. And that was a COVID year. So I was locked in my dorm most of the time, with my roommate, and I was basically going to class and coming back to my dorm, seeing my friends sometimes, but mostly class dorm. It was a lot of work and it was very labor intensive, but I also had a lot of time to do it. I'm actually very proud of myself that I was able to like keep up my work schedule consistently. And I had the book fully drawn by the time I graduated. And I think a couple, like 2 or 3 weeks to like finish coloring it and like get the book printed to like have it done. And this new book that I just finished, I was working on it while also working a day job and also taking commissions and also doing conventions and art shows and all sorts of things. So that one was this more pages than this done in more of a time constraint with more things going on in my life. So I'd say, and visually it's a way more complicated book. And I feel bad that I can't talk about it more.
Okay. So, you know, we're getting further into this interview. And you told me about Peppermint Desert, and I asked you a little bit about, you know, your interest in horror. I want to ask another question in regards to horror in the comic book realm. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what makes a good horror comic? Or a comic with horror elements?
Comic with horror? I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of the way that I don't know. I feel like for me, it comes down to the storytelling, because that's a lot of the reason why I do comics. Like, I love drawing and I love the art form of comics, but mostly my number one thing is like, I'm a storyteller, and this is the most efficient way to tell those stories, like unconstrained by budget or anything. So I think when it comes to horror, so much of horror comes down to the storytelling and the execution, and, you know, combining that with visuals is an art on its own. There's certainly something to be said for pacing and, you know, the quality of the artwork. You know, like, can so-and-so art style do justice to this certain story? You know, like, I don't super think that, like, if there were to be a graphic novel adaptation of like Seven, I don't think I'm the guy for that. I think my version wouldn't do justice to that story, because I don't really think that's what my art style caters to. But I think my art style could really cater to like something in the vein of like Universal Monsters, or like a B movie from the 60s or something. You know, going back to pacing, like, I think we've all experienced that thing of like, you're reading a comic and something like, there's a lot of tension building. There's a crazy thing that's about to happen and you just can't help yourself. And your eyes just slide down to the bottom of the page and you spoil it for yourself before you've like really read all the way there, you know? So it's like knowing where to place the shocks and the scary stuff so that like it sneaks up on you. I think that's a big thing that a lot of comics creators take for granted.
Okay. So when it comes down to making your own comics and everything, and even just working on different things, when it comes to the placement of the panels and everything, do you have your own process for doing that? Or do you like just, this is going to happen here, this is going to happen there?
I do have a process for doing that. I work off of a script. I always script my comics before I draw them. And usually when I'm scripting, I'm thinking a little bit about like how much information is on a page. Usually it's just about like the number of panels. And like once you hit a certain panel count on a page, like once I get to like 8-9 panels, it's like, okay, I should go to a new page. But sometimes you want to, you know, split it up by like, you know, oh, like this moment would hit so well if it happens like at the top of this page or at the bottom of this page, or if it happens on like a page turn. And so once I have that script, I'll like look at the number of panels and I'll just do like very, very small thumbnails of what the page will look like. And I'm not even drawing the content of the page. I'm literally just laying out the panels. And usually I'll start with a very simple grid, like the simplest way of conveying the information, you know, keeping in mind what's happening in the panel. Like if you have a panel where like someone is lunging across the room, like that panel will probably want to be very horizontal, because if it's vertical, you know, you run into problems with being able to show like the distance that somebody, you know, or if you're very, very good at creative composition, maybe you don't have that problem, but it's something that I'm thinking about. And then for like in Peppermint Desert, there are some pretty insane panel layouts in some parts. Let me pull one up. Like this sequence has like a very eclectic kind of like way that it's laid out with like these these like white lines that kind of like guide your eye through it.
Love
and that started as a very simple grid that looked like a more traditional comic page. And then I was thinking, okay, I want the sequence to be really, really dynamic and have a crazy layout and like really draw your eye to different places. So how can I manipulate this layout in a way that accomplishes that? So I'll take my very basic grid layout and then start abstracting things. I'll like shrink certain panels or make certain panels into like unconventional shapes. I'll like take my gutters and make them diagonal, or just like fuck around and see what happens. And that's how I've gotten some of my more like out there panel layouts. I can get very nerdy about panel layouts because I think it's something unique to the art form of comics that you can really have a lot of fun with. And you know, I'm a big fan of like Alphonse Mucha and a lot of the like old like Art Nouveau poster artists from the turn of the century. Okay. Who have these wild like graphic layouts for their posters that look totally ahead of their time. And I just think that stuff is interesting. And so when I am making a comic page, if it's a sequence where there are stakes, where there is tension, where there is action, I will do everything I can to like avoid just doing a basic grid. I will want to do something that's like more dynamic or interesting to look at, because it adds so much to the tone and the tension and the pace, but it also just adds so much visual interest that like your eye is going to linger on the page for longer and really drink in that information. If it has to like take a second to really follow the flow of everything that's going on.
So I know earlier you were talking about how you even, some of your inspiration comes from movies as well too. So when it comes down to you making the panel layouts and everything, are you sometimes inspired by like different movie shots, or is it more so just like whatever your brain comes up with to really get the best action?
A lot of the times it's what my brain comes up with. It's a lot of it is about like conducting the flow of your eye, of just like making sure that your eye reads the information in the correct order, and like travels across the page seamlessly. And so a lot of times like the shots and the geometry of the page will be dictated by like how I can get your eye to start at the top left corner and go to the bottom right corner.
Okay.
That being said, sometimes there is like, you know, certain shots or imagery that might be inspired by certain movies. That happens once or twice, again, in the book I'm not allowed to talk about yet. But please have me back on when I'm allowed to talk about it, because I would love to talk your ear off about it when I'm able.
Listen, you can come on anytime you want.
Word, okay.
So cool. Fantastic. If you got something, let me know. I'll squeeze you in.
Will do.
Okay. So, got one more question about your career so far, and then we're gonna play a little game.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so Fog. Tell me a little bit about what Fog is.
Okay, let's talk about Fog. Wow, I didn't think you were gonna bring this up. Okay, so for years, I have to flashback all the way back to like high school. I have had this idea in my head for years, for this like shared universe of comics that I want to eventually do one day. And I'm still working on it. I actually just recently was kind of fucking around with a concept for a new thing set in this universe. But basically, it's the setting called Sorrow City, which is this, I consider it a fantasy setting, but it's kind of this like gothic steampunk kind of like vaguely magical setting, where it's just this like this city that on the surface kind of resembles, you know, like a gothic like European slash American city, but the longer you spend there, the more you realize that it is kind of like strange and alien. It's very anachronistic. You can't really tell what year it is, and it's this just dark city where strange things happen. And I've known for years that I want to tell stories in this universe, and I kind of started in high school and then shelved it, and I brought it back after my first year of college, because I was like, okay, if I want to make comics, I should make a comic. So I came up with this concept for a comic that starred this character who originated as a supporting character in another character's story, but then I gave him his own thing. And this character's name was Fog. And I built out this story for him that was meant to be this like very serialized short comic that I could just do between projects forever. And it was going to be this big sprawling like fantasy saga about this man who wakes up one day and finds his wife gone, missing. And in her place is this blue rose that has come out of nowhere. He doesn't know where it came from. And so he goes about this quest through the city to try and find out what happened to his wife. And in each chapter, the journey gets increasingly strange and surreal. And it becomes increasingly clear that whatever happened to his wife, it wasn't violent. It wasn't a kidnapping. It was something supernatural and like otherworldly. And I never completed enough chapters to get into what it actually was. But it let me, that was the story. And so narratively, that's what it was. But then practically what it was an opportunity for me to just play around. And each chapter, I kind of changed something about the style or the media or, you know, my style of writing. And I just kind of just used that as like a training ground to develop my skills in making comics. And I got four chapters in. I think my original outline was going to be like 25 chapters or something. And then after the fourth chapter, which is one of my favorite comics I've ever made. I think it actually turned out really good. I made it years ago now and I stand by it. But eventually it got to the point where I was in college, I was doing other projects. I knew I was going to start freelancing and I thought, okay, if I really want to tell this story, it can't happen like this. And I got really, really attached to this character and this concept. And so I kind of put the series on the back burner. And one day when I have the time and the resources, I would like to go back to it and kind of like start over and do a definitive Fog and like tell the whole story that I wanted to tell. And that's what Fog is.
Okay. That sounds like an epic.
It was, yeah. It was, the original idea was that it was going to be kind of in the same vein as Will Eisner's Spirit comics. It was going to be like, each chapter was only going to be like 9 or 10 pages. They would be very small vignettes, and like each chapter would be one small thing that happens like on the road to Fog finding his wife. And like other characters showed up, and like, you know, like there was a cast of supporting characters. And then eventually, like, I got to the third chapter, and instead of 9, it was 11 pages. And then the fourth chapter was 16. And I think the fifth chapter was going to be longer. And then it got to the point where it was like, my eyes were too big for my stomach, and it became like unsustainable. So I kind of had to put it on the back burner. You know, it was an early passion project that I want to return to one day, but probably not for a while.
Okay.
But if anyone who's watching this wants to read them, they're all on my website. So have at it.
So since this was an early passion project and everything, if you were to go back to Fog right now, would there be any things you want to change to it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there would. In the second chapter, there's a character who is introduced, this character called Rhiannon, who is this girl that Fog meets in this like underground tunnel system, who's being held prisoner. And she has these like mysterious magical powers that she can't really explain and doesn't really know where they came from or how they work. But it is immediately clear that whatever she is, whatever's up with her powers, it has something to do with Fog's wife. And I don't love the way that I introduced her. I think I was trying to be very edgy, and looking back, I think it was like maybe not in the best taste, the way that I wrote her introduction. And so if I went back, I would definitely change the way that she enters the story. And then there are also just like other things I would change that are like plot contrivances that would just be like, you know, if I were to write the story again, it would be a much more streamlined, like, economical story. I think the first few chapters kind of meander because I was like kind of still trying to figure out what I wanted it to be. Now I have a much more concise idea of how I would tell that story.
Hmm. Okay, well, game time.
All right,
I'll add some music in here. But okay, are you ready? Let's begin. Okay, so like I said previously, I did some deep dives on you. I looked into some stuff. I don't really think this is that deep. You were a musical theater kid.
Yeah. Yes, I was. Yeah.
Okay, so we got two things. First one is a little game of, you know, which would you prefer? Then finally, got a little special thing. Then we'll close out this episode. First one, Heathers or Mean Girls?
Heathers. Are we talking the musicals?
Yes, musicals.
Just musicals? Heathers, easily. Winner. The music from Heathers is so good. Actually, me and my roommates, my sophomore year of college, our group Halloween costume was, we did gender bent Heathers.
I love that.
And so I was like the male version of the green Heather. The Mean Girls musical is like fine, in my opinion. It has some bangers, but Heathers is like all bangers.
Wait, you said it's fine?
The Mean Girls musical?
Yeah.
It's okay.
No, like, it's fine. Like the song.
Oh, yeah. Is that I've only listened to the full transparency. The only song that I really, really know from Mean Girls is Apex Predator.
Okay.
Because that song rules. But the number of times I have listened to Dead Girl Walking is like innumerable.
To this day, whenever I put my phone on shuffle and then anything from Heathers comes on, I'm singing that shit. Full volume.
Yeah, you have to.
You gotta.
Yeah. Freeze your brain. You gotta go for it.
You gotta. All right. Heathers or Seussical?
I'd still say Heathers. When I was a child, like a young child, I was in a production of Seussical. And I don't remember very much of it. And I don't remember any of the music. I love Dr. Seuss, but I think I like Heathers more.
Okay. Heathers or Chicago?
Ooh, now that's a good question. I feel like it would be sacrilege to prefer Heathers over Chicago.
Yeah.
I do really like Chicago. I think I'll have to choose Chicago.
Okay. Chicago or Sweet Charity?
I haven't seen Sweet Charity. Really? So I'm gonna go Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. You'd be shocked some of the shit I haven't seen.
I like Sweet Charity. Sweet Charity is like, you know, another Fozzie production situation. And I'd like Chicago better. I think Chicago is like a little bit more iconic for me. Mm-hmm. Sweet Charity only got maybe like two songs, whereas like Chicago, almost every single song to me in this household is like hit after hit after hit. Okay. Chicago or In the Heights.
Oh, you know, okay. I do like Chicago more than In the Heights, but I do love In the Heights.
Okay.
In the Heights is the superior Lin-Manuel Miranda production, in my opinion.
Mm-mm-mm. You know what?
Look, Hamilton had its time. Hamilton had its time, and we all had our fun with it, and it is what it is now. But I think In the Heights has aged better.
I think In the Heights has aged better. Hamilton, it gets a little cringy. Now. I don't know if
it's a little hard to listen to now.
Yeah.
It's none of us are in the mood.
I can't. Okay. Let's jump ship to one more thing. Broadway is wanting their biggest new musical or either stage production, right? And they have all the money in the world, and they also have all the permissions from every single combo publisher. And they say, hey, Sean, we want you to work on this. We want you to come up with this, come up with the set design, maybe even come up with the playbill, and also come up with what show we're doing, right? The whole shebang, right? And they say, which comic book character or comic book in general are we going to be turning into a Broadway musical or stage production? How would you pitch it? And why did you choose it?
That is such... Oh, man, you have put me on the spot. That is such a fun question. I'm looking over at my comic book collection right now to try and figure out what I would do. This is hard. Okay. I'll say the very first thing that came to my mind, which I don't know if this is the best idea, but it is the first thing that occurred to me. Okay. Do a musical, like high budget Broadway production adaptation of The Sandman.
You know, it makes so much sense. I would never have even thought of that. Like it makes sense.
And you do it. And you do it, and this will ruffle some feathers. This will get people pissed off. You do it in the same style. You do it in the same, like, structure as Cats, where it's like there's not one through line of plot. It's kind of like a lot of vignettes that are, like, that kind of have, like, a through line, because that's what Sandman is. It's like, it's kind of a lot of short stories that are loosely connected by the presence of a few different characters. Alternatively, here's the other idea that came to mind.
You sold me unrelated. The first one, though. You sold me the first one.
Sandman's great. The other one I would do, and this could be, like, the next Heathers, the next Mean Girls, the next, like, thing that all the theater kids are going crazy over. I would love to see a musical theater adaptation of Deadly Class by Rick Remender.
Okay.
I just think, like, you could make the ultimate, like, edgy theater kid, like, pop punk musical out of Deadly Class. I would love to watch that.
Okay, you got some winners right there. You know, honestly, you saying this, the second one made me think about this. What if there was, like, we're going to do X-Men First Class, but, like, I'm talking X-Men First Class, and then kind of, like, make the style kind of like, you know, Mean Girls or Heathers, really, like, do that Y2K shit, but kind of have it, like, be, mm-hmm. like, X-Men mm-hmm. Evolution.
Ooh.
I feel like that'd be great.
I think it would be great. And, like, the great thing with the X-Men is, like, you can do the training uniforms, and then, like, the, like, beginning of Act 2 is, like, everybody gets their, like, costumes and, like,
yes.
Broadway versions of, like, the Storm costume or, like, the Phoenix costume.
And it'd be dope.
And it would be dope. It'd be so rad. As long as we can avoid, like, Spider-Man turn off the dark shit and, like, all the stunts work and pyrotechnics. If we can get all that stuff to work, dude, X-Men musical, I'm all about it.
Imagine the light design with Cyclops' powers, though.
Cyclops' powers. And it's like some of those characters in the X-Men were just like, you know, like so much of X-Men going back to like the 70s and 80s is like very like queer coded in a way that I think would lend itself to Broadway very well. Not that Broadway is like inherently queer or anything like that, but Mr. Sinister on a Broadway stage? Are you kidding me? That's what that character was written for.
Oh my god. He'd be so sassy. Like, he would be honestly, I feel like he'd be the villain.
The way that Kieran Gillen writes
yes.
Mr. Sinister, he writes him as a musical theater kid. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, it'd be great.
I feel like he would be the villain great. That everyone Dude. Wants to play. Like, he would be the character everyone yes. would want to play. Like any high school production.
People Mr. Sinister is, like, the character that every week of the Broadway production, they, like, cycle in, like, a new celebrity guest actor.
Yes, he's, like,
to
the
To play
anchor.
Mr. Sinister.
Yeah.
He's the anchor. Dude, the crazy set design to, like, represent a sentinel
on stage. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking kind of similar to, like, you know, Into the Woods with the way they did the giant or whatever.
Yeah, with the giants, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be cool as hell. Or then also mention the Danger Room or even, like, Cerebro and shit.
Yeah.
Or even the Blackbird. Like,
dude, Professor X's song while he uses Cerebro. The opening of the X-Men musical has to be a number where it's Professor X singing some sort of song while he's using Cerebro. And we do, like, a musical, like, we have a song that's basically like the first few pages of Giant Size X-Men yes. number one, where he's like going around the world and like recruiting Storm and Nightcrawler and you know, Sunfire, whoever else, you know.
Exactly.
It'd be great.
And then have like the yeah. song kind of like interpolate the 90s theme. Like, it's not fully the 90s theme. It's not, but like,
but it's in
you
there.
Can hear
yeah.
you can just hear it's like what? What?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Mic yeah. drop. I would also say, I think an Incredible Hulk musical. And hold on.
Okay.
Like, make it, like, I want it to be serious. Like, make it really serious. There could still be action. There could still be, like, some Hulk shit. But, like,
yeah,
make it kind of like Jekyll and Hyde.
Right.
That'd be dope.
Like, like, next to normal energy, but with the Hulk. Yeah, I can see it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so that was our interview with Sean Peacock.
All right.
Soups, thanks for sitting here. And also, Sean, thank you for being on this episode. It was a blast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for letting me ramble. It's been awesome. I'm happy to be here.
Of course. And Soups, go check out Peppermint Desert, and also go check out Sean's work. Like, when I tell you Sean's work is fucking amazing. He even recently did a Spider-Punk poster with I love the little Easter egg you put Lila Shaney on there.
Yes.
And the Mary Janes, that's great. Dude, I love that. I love that so much.
Maybe, I think there have been maybe, you are maybe like the third person. I did that illustration, like, it's a fan art illustration that I sell at conventions. I did it for fun. But I did it like over a year ago now. And in that time, I think you are like the third person to comment on Lila Cheney being part of the lineup. Because the average person does not know who Lila Cheney is, but I am a crazy X-Men nerd, so I'm it's like, of course she's there. It wouldn't be Dazzler. It's way too punk rock for her.
You know, it's funny because when I was when I first saw it at Comic-Con recently, we were walking past, and I told my partner, because my partner was like, oh my god, I like this, da, 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 da. And I was like, oh, he put Lila Cheney in there. And then my partner was like, who's that? And I was like, listen, babe, Lila Cheney is like one of the coolest mutants and shit like that. It was like a fucking rocker and all that type of shit.
It's easy. It's like, have you heard of Joan Jett? Imagine her, but she can teleport. That's Lila Cheney.
Basically.
Sounds awesome, right?
Yeah. Badass as hell. Badass as hell. All right. Well, if you guys want to check out Sean's art, be sure to check him out. And once you check him out, comment on this video, comment on the show, just leave, you know, leave some type of critiques, do something. Be sure to let us know on Instagram at Super Saturdays Podcast, TikTok at Super Saturdays Pod, and Twitter at Super Saturday PC, where all of your messages and your reviews can make their way on the show. This was Super Saturdays. I'm Damon.
I'm Sean. Was that my cue?
That was your cue. That was your cue.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am Sean.
And Sean, where can the Supes find you and find all of your wonderful art?
Yeah, you can find me on All Sorrows at every on everything. Instagram, all.sorrows. Twitter, all_sorrows. TikTok, all.sorrows. AllSorrows.com. Yeah, follow me. I am super annoying. I post all the time. I'm always working on stuff, and I'm always happy to talk about it, unless I'm contractually obligated not to talk about it. But that's not that many. That's not that much stuff. Usually I can talk about what I'm up to.
Okay, okay. And I'll be sure to have you on for to talk about the thing that you can't talk about right now.
Yes. All right. I mentioned it so many times. I should not have, but I look forward to that conversation.
I do too. All right, as always, see you next Saturday, Supes.